Willkommen bei Karma mal so machen, der Podcast für Menschen, die verstehen wollen, warum das Leben so passiert, wie es ihnen passiert. Karmic Management hat großartige Antworten auf diese Frage und bietet dir jede Menge Tools, um die Kontrolle über dein Leben zurückzugewinnen. Mein Name ist Eva, ich studiere und praktiziere die karmischen Prinzipien seit über 15 Jahren und ich teile hier mein Wissen mit dir. Wenn ich deine Karma-Frage im Podcast beantworten soll, melde dich gern. Und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Karma mal so machen. Gestern gab es ja schon im Rahmen des Podcasts eine besondere Ausgabe zum Thema ALL, die Asian Legacy Library. Und die Brigitte hat erklärt, was das für eine wundervolle Organisation ist und warum ich und viele andere Menschen sie unterstützen. Jetzt habe ich ein Special für dich. Und zwar habe ich die Gelegenheit gehabt, mit dem Präsidenten von ALL auch noch ein Interview zu führen. Und das ist der John Brady und der ist heute bei mir und der wohnt aber in Amerika, möchte ich dazu sagen, und deswegen spricht er natürlich nur Englisch. Das heißt, dieser Podcast findet ausnahmsweise als Special auf Englisch statt und wenn du kein Englisch sprichst oder nicht so gut sprichst, schau doch diese Folge gerne auf YouTube, denn auf YouTube gibt es deutsche Untertitel. Und es ist, denke ich, schon sehr besonders, mit so einem erfahrenen und wundervollen Karma-Spezialisten zu sprechen wie John Brady. Ich fühle mich sehr geehrt, dass er halt bei mir ist. Und deswegen schaust du dir ruhig an, auch wenn du kein Englisch sprichst, da gibt es Übersetzungen. Aber ich gehe jetzt ins Englische und der Rest des Podcasts findet dann auf Englisch statt. So, welcome, dear John. It's so wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Eva. It's been a long study of getting me on this show, and I'm finally happy to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm so happy you are. Yeah. So, as I told everyone already, we already covered a couple of basics of ALL, but perhaps you want, from your perspective as the president, give us the latest updates and the greatest news, what you want to share, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit of a story. I've been trying to structure today and yesterday structure a presentation of Asian Legacy Library for our staff who are flying into Sedona and coming for a week for our annual conference. And I thought, let me go on ChatGPT and see what they have to say about Asian Legacy Library. So it was so much fun to feel so important and have the enhancement of chat kind of gave me this, I never thought about that. That's so cool that we never say that we do this or that so exquisitely. So I was kind of impressed with who we are from chat's point of view. And I just got back, my wife and I just got back from a two-week tour teaching and doing work for Asian Legacy Library. And from the standpoint of people overseas who understand what we do, they love what we do. And it has to do with the Asian mind of understanding the precious nature of wisdom in the form of manuscripts. And it's just in their culture, it's in their mind stream that you can't not want to save the authentic traditions of these ancient wisdoms that we specifically call Buddhism and Sanskrit dialects of commentaries on Buddhism. But they are enormously grateful for that. Whereas the U.S. is like, oh yeah, that, ALL, like, they're doing pretty good work, But it's a very different contrast because of the culture. So we have exerted ourselves to expand the idea, the concept of a 150-year plan for Asian Legacy Library. And so we are now at a point where another self-realization is that we're, as much as a preservationist, we're also a technology company. Mm-hmm. And the technology side of ALL has been neglected for about 5-6 years. Nothing from the technological aspect has been redistributing the generous multiplicity amount of data. I mean, 750,000 pages of searchable, mostly Buddhist data, you know, and now 3.8 million scans of original texts. So the technology side, my biggest expense when I look at, I'm just looking at my profit and loss for 2025 yesterday, and my biggest expense was technology because we're behind. So the last two and a half years, we've developed a five-person IT team around the world under the guidance of my director, Joel Crawford. And we officially launched our technology systems last May and then developed five or six new tools for searchability on our website. And the beauty of what we're seeing being acknowledged in academic institutions around the world is the linked data systems that we develop. So if you're a scholar and you're interested in a commentary and or the original work of a second century Sanskrit commentary on what the Buddha really meant in 560 BC, the data links are working simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So we will have scans if you bring up the title, and those scans are in traditional Sanskrit, Tibetan. Even now, we have some Chinese from 5th, 6th century from the Dongguan caves. And that, for a scholar, along with what we call transliteration, is a perfect dream for scholars to actually translate properly. And then if you have different places where those commentaries were reprinted and somebody added more commentary to the commentary, that gets interesting from a standpoint of measuring these two different printeries writing apparently the same, you know, thing. So we have new tools that excite people, and academia is responding. And then the other strange phenomena that happened the last 2 years, but predominantly this year, there is a monastery from the tradition of the founder, Jason Kappa, of the Gelug tradition, His Holiness's tradition. And one of his main home monasteries is called Kumbum, Kumbum Monastery. It's now, 780 years old. It's still thriving. It's a pilgrimage site for mainland Chinese and others. And we started discovering their stamps of that printery are on a whole series that we discovered in Mongolia this year. And so they haven't seen the day of light for, I don't know, 100 years, maybe longer. So that spurred really a big interest in academia, to the point where we never ask for, you know, recommendations. But recently I had to ask for recommendations by heads of humanities programs, Buddhist studies programs, and they flew in. We have 12 or 13 heads of departments of Buddhist studies around the world saying, this is incredible work in Mongolia. Please never stop. We love, keep it coming, keep it coming. So that entry point is really, we've been absent. And this entry point is so exciting again, because we're getting acknowledged, but at the same time, we're being literally used multi times a week to find data from various scholastic institutions around the world. So to me, that's more exciting, because we were on ice for a long time. Mm-hmm. I went to a digital preservation conference at Columbia University in 2020, just before COVID started, and everyone was there, like all the pretty impressive long-term preservationists of Buddhist studies. And somebody came over and said, you're John Brady, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, what do you do now? Like, since you know, your organization kind of closed down. I was like, oh my God, that's where we are. People think that we're gone. And so we're back, and that excites the heck out of me. And it's, I think the staff is like just excited about what we're, you know, what we're all about. And so that's a new entry point in a new way to bring ourselves back into the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Remind me again, how long have you been doing this?
Well, on and off, I've been doing it for 27 and a half years.
Right.
Yeah. And we were state-of-the-art technology starting in 2000 up to 2008, 9, 10. Like, articles were being written in, you know, magazines like Wired Up, which is a pure tech magazine. It was amazing, the ride we took.
Mm.
And, you know, suddenly I did a 3-year retreat and came out and nothing was going on and no data was being produced in terms of distribution. And then the founder, Geshe Michael Roach, said, you've got to do it again and take it over. So I took it over at the end of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And always we were broke. So the first thing was to help get on the road and, you know, preach the message again about who we are.
Yeah, well, I think we you did a great job. That's why I like, you know, not just me. We like to call you the Indiana Jones of the old scriptures. You know?
Oh my God! Yeah,
so, you know, go about and finding these things, and you've been relentless. And you know, I think the job you've done is totally incredible with your team. Also,
right.
I have, I know these people.
I have a great team. It took me a while to assemble. You know, I came from a corporate background, as you know, so. My company, when I was in that world of corporate life, and we had a reputation called golden handcuffs. Work for this company, you're going to be paid a ton of money, but you better get a 2-year contract, no matter how much they seduce you, because we were run by a famous woman entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
Who was essentially probably one of the most pioneering women in the industry that I was in. And she ran it, you know, autonomy to the top CEO level. And I, you know, it was a joke, you know, like, oh, how many years have you been working for this company? 18 months? And it was like, no, I've been there 17 and a half years. So there was a nice correlation of fitting the mold that she wanted for me to grow a division that I ran for her. And that, you know, that was training. It was, you know, corporate, you know, culture is essential for running anything. A nonprofit is the same thing. You have to, you know, really, really clean house when it's necessary. And unfortunately, I had to do that the last couple of years, 3 years. And now we love what we do, and we are SWAT teaming constantly together, making things work. So we're
super
happy
cool.
As an organization.
Yeah, that's super cool.
Inside,
see, the results are coming, and you're saving all these scripts like crazy. So, and I think if you think about the reaction of the academic world, I think that's also a sign of something is working out. And because if it's recognized, it's much more valued. There's no point doing it for the world if the world doesn't use it. So it's really cool if the world actually does use it and understands its value. I think that's fantastic.
The other thing that happened this year a lot more is people rediscovering the pioneering work of the founder of Asian Legacy Library, Geshe Michael.
Mm-hmm.
So where we are with optical character recognition systems for Sanskrit and Tibetan is quite sophisticated, extremely sophisticated, actually. And what we've done that contributed to the pioneering work of translations of these great books from Asia is the transliteration, the system where every scholar uses to translate into any language. You know, Swahili, you can do it from, you know, our transliteration. And that 760,000 page searchable transliteration has been fed into AI systems to bring us to a place where our data has become the main influence in AI's translatable aspects into any language. So we're getting a lot of, we never get compliments. Usually they're broke scholars who need, you know, just to get the data, never to donate. We never ask them for money and get out. They just get the data, get out and do their work. But the recent thing with the AI influence now in optical character recognition translations is pretty powerful. And the foremost people that are recognized in the languages from the Buddhist lineages who are AIing the language have pretty much basically used our model of transliteration throughout the years. So that's a big deal. That means that the translation has an accuracy from the transliteration from the original language. So that excites me. And we just got a compliment yesterday from the University of Vienna, who basically take the canons of the Buddhist lineages and offer them and distribute them. And they used our famous 400,000-page canon as an example of work that we do. And that was sweet. You know, we're starting to get back into like recognized compliments online and very blogs nice. And things. So that happens once in a while, and it makes me happy.
I mean, The other thing we could do, I don't know whether you want to share anything else, but, you know, you can have an abstract interest in saving ancient scriptures because you understand they are sort of valuable kind of to the world in a very abstract sense. But you and I know that these ideas have a very concrete, everyday life, real relevance for us because my whole podcast is based on these ideas. I wouldn't exist without them. So many people benefit from it. And so I was hoping that perhaps I can ask you a difficult question and you can give us, because obviously you've studied these ideas, not just collected them and saved them.
Yeah.
So do you want to go into this now? Or
sure. Why not?
Yeah. Because one question I got recently apparently was, I'm always stuck at a certain place, sort of. It's like a glass ceiling. It's very difficult for me to break up this limit I seem to have. And I'm sure we can take something from wonderful ideas to answer that question.
Spiritual glass ceilings.
Yeah. They were talking obviously business, but it could be spiritual. It could be, you know. But money off.
Well, business is, you can say business is as spiritual as anything if you're really evolving and understanding, you know, good business, ethical business is extraordinarily powerful in the world right now.
Mm, I agree. So what would you tell someone who says, I want to, you know, really break out of my limitations, I think that's what they're asking, because I think that's a really we feel like imprisoned by invisible barriers that don't allow us to go beyond of what we are. So I don't know what do you think we can say would be correlation, what could be advice
from the standpoint of philosophical worldviews based on Buddhism and parts of the Buddhist system. And I want to be perfectly clear, and this is my stance from many years of study and practice. Buddhism transcends religion beyond what the label of Buddhism does to you and I. It sticks, it keeps a glass ceiling on it. People have this concept that Buddhism is, oh, it's a top seven religion of the world, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, of course it is, you know. But for the first time in history, the West finally got it right and realized how the aspect of the philosophical worldviews of what's inside these books that we're saving and what's going on with the translation of these books totally transcends religion. It is a analytical exercise that's, you know, could take years of self-realization, though, depending on who you are, of the nature of reality, the true nature of reality, because we are, in a way, what you're saying, a glass ceiling is some kind of a stickiness of what else is there to do with my life, or what else is there to achieve, or what else is there to understand. And people get stuck in a place where the growth of their own personal evolution stagnates. And that's where these ideas show a different point of view, a worldview that is like, no, escalation of your own personal growth and the evolution of understanding, which is, you know, wrapped in a wisdom package, needs to be unpacked and clearly defined through universal principles, which I love, instead of the word of dependent origination or interdependence, we can use the idea that there are universal principles. And, you know, we want to say, and we want to admit, and maybe we don't, that science is our God. We are in the God of science right now. And it functions quite sophisticatedly with AI now around the corner being mobilized on a global level. So God is science to you and I. And where is Buddha's philosophical worldview in the quantum level of science? And where does it exist and how can it be functioning? And I don't know if I can be believed in the concept of what this great adept and then the lineages passing through him created, but we can say from the perspective of an academic view that science is the lowest level of understanding the nature of reality. In the compositions, that's 2,700 years old, the compositions of direct experiences. Subatomic particles are explained in Buddhism from one of the great books, 150 AD. And it's so clear that they kept looking curtain after curtain to see the nature of reality down to a place of subatomic particles. They knew about molecular systems, and they were convinced that was the base level of reality. These little protons, electrons, molecules, even some of the names are still being used, muons. And, you know, so what was going on back then? You know, people realize that the nature, and so far also in the West, you know, the Greeks, Aristotle and Plato talked about the subatomic particle world of nature. So there was something moving in those times where they understood on a very deep level the basis, and maybe even our Western quantum systems that we have now source from those times. So that discovery basically was a beginning of a debate about the actual nature of reality. And in the beginning of the evolution of trying to decode these great works of this enlightened, so-called enlightened being, which is a whole other story, evolved into a deeper understanding, saying no. That's only the base understanding of the nature of reality. You have other levels of transcendence that actually don't have anything to do with molecules and atoms and protons. And that's really the case in point where Buddhism departed from what is labeled in the West as a religion, and we shouldn't mix it up with science. And, you know, there are some wonderful things to watch where there are debates between quantum physics. Sean Carroll is very big in America. He's at Caltech. He debates Alan Wallace, who is a physicist, who is also one of the great scholars of our time in Buddhism. And they debate about it. And they hold their stance really strong, because really in science, the science question is there anything beyond the materialism of subatomic particles? And they refuse to budge. And where Buddhism says, like, don't get lost in this permanency of you thinking that your reality is made up of this table, this computer, our photons flowing and subatomic particles coming together to make something that feels like it's solid, you know? And the debate goes on, but we're stuck in that permanency too, you and I. We're stuck in it, and we think this thing is permanent, and that gives us problems. And we think that this person and John Brady, whoever John Brady is labeled these days, and, you know, Eva Dulser, whatever label is being produced these days, is permanent. That's my identity. And that's probably the greatest debate in Buddhism, right, in my world, is like, what permanence is John Brady? And is that creating a glass ceiling of an identity that doesn't allow me to go deeper into an aspect of who we can be? And that's what's fascinating to me right now. It's like, is there this self-standing John Brady that is unchanging? And that gets us in such trouble. It gets us in such trouble because the concept of a self-standing me, or mine, as we say, has been written, thousands of pages have been written about the idea that you have to deconstruct that idea and realize that you are a changing, ever momentary changing being. And that possibility of changing momentary me is not the me you were at the beginning of this podcast. And we have to get our heads around that. And that's a bigger story. But the glass ceiling is that we can't, you know, move ourselves out of this self-labeled me and mine. And that we can take it from the standpoint of that's one of my glass ceilings in my life right now. It's like, how do I like lift this thing off? Because my relationship to the world is self-standing. And that gets me in trouble. It gets me in trouble every day. And because you don't take responsibility, or you do, about how things happen to you and why things happen to you and what happens when things happen to you in the way you think about it. And that is the problem with most of humanity. And, you know, we got to wake up. That's what to wake up in my exciting moments of, you know, teaching right now, because we're in an amazing time, opportunistically, to understand the nature of reality through science and through great philosophical worldviews like Buddhism.
Wow, very beautiful. I mean, I got, it's also very logical, and that's what I like about these ideas and these principles, that because I'm a logical person, science used to be my God, surely. But, you know, and but science is, in a way, I agree with you, very limited, because it only explains the what of things, you know, how things happen, but not the why. And people want to know, why do these things happen to me? Not how, kind of, and, you know, that means I cannot change it. And I got an email yesterday, or the day before yesterday, by a woman said, I read your first, I'm doing a course on financial freedom at the moment, and said, I read your introduction to this thing, and you said it's so logical, and I'm supposed to be thinking, I'm so grateful you said that, because normally these coaches always tell me I should feel something, and I don't want to feel, I want to understand. And she was so grateful, and I said, yeah, that's the whole point. You do get to an incredible feeling about yourself and the world and the love you feel to other people, that develops when you understand the nature of reality, which is, you know, that things are, that only if you do something for others, you can actually change that glass ceiling. Because I think that's what you're implying, you know.
Yeah, karmic correlations.
I think I'm limited, you know, I'm limited in who I am, but that's totally impossible. And I think, and what I love about these principles is this, it always opens a limitless opportunities, because I'm nothing. I call us as the seed box. Yeah, we're nothing more than seed boxes, really. And, you know, right. And if you change your seed box, anything is possible. So I think definitely, what you're saying yeah. is if we understand more about karma, basically, and how we operate and how the world works, then it's not going to be a problem at all to break glass ceilings and to break, get out of
situations. It's so true. Karma has this kind of juju around it. It's one of the most misunderstood concepts of many religions. I mean, it doesn't have a clarity in the mainstream of our times. I think it, you know, we have these little sayings, what goes around comes around. That's kind of cool. You know, karma's like a boomerang. It gets back to you. But when you got to dig deeper and understand the combinations of concepts that have to come together to make it work for you, because the first step in my life is always, what do I have to take responsibility for today, and how do I move through the world in a total responsible way and own everything that's going to happen to me, good, bad, neutral. And we don't do that. We're culturally, we are totally against that. We don't want to take responsibility. I call America, you know, there's beautiful statistics these days that go deeper into our cultures, different cultures. And what is fascinating, we're a culture of law. There are more lawyers in America than the whole of Europe. You know, lawyers are the fuel throughout our systems, where in the Asian world and mainland, engineering is the motor, the technology of a culture that is, you know, I go to mainland, it's thriving. People have no idea how extraordinary this miracle over the 45-year period has happened in that country, struggling like everyone else, but still. But the lawyer thing in America has made Americans identifying, I'm a victim, and I can sue anyone in the world I want from the standpoint of, you victimized me. I read something on social about, you know, me, and I'm going to sue you. And it is so defended in our time that you can sue, and it keeps the lawyers thriving. And that is probably the worst example, among others, these days with my country, where you know, you are you can justify your victimhood, and that's a downward spiral in your evolution. And are there times where you're justified to bring, you know, a suit against somebody? Yes. I'm not saying, you know, the system does function dysfunctionally. It functions. But the idea is that where you feel victimized is the starting point for a different evolution of breaking through your glass ceiling. And that's where you play. You play in, oh, you know, he said this to me yesterday afternoon, and I am so angry. And then you don't sleep for like 5 hours because you're reviewing your story. And that story redefends your position that you were right. And this is the cycle of what we call illusory, deceptive reality. And from my standpoint, that's the battle we play every day, that we are trying to be in this place where whoever did whatever to you and vice versa has no, you know, the idea of no correlation of what we call what goes around comes around. You know, we don't feel responsible. And that's what keeps us on this glass ceiling idea. How do we unpack that? One thing that you know is in the sense of my own personal travels, when you do something for somebody else, as you said at the beginning of the show, it doesn't mean that you have to like spend, you know, a full day at the nursing home or taking care of somebody who needs groceries in their house because they're shut-ins or whatever you do. One thing that the human mind refuses to acknowledge is to feel good about the good things you do for others. And it's around the world. When you hear somebody say, I'm doing this universal principle called the four steps. You know, I know what I want. You know, I want financial freedom. And I'm going to find ways that show value in the world that I can donate to, or I know credible people who have financial means challenges because they have two children. The family is, you know, double working, the husband and wife, but maybe I can do something for that family and take the kids to the movies and let them have a day off. Or, you know, how are you helping others in your world for what you want? And how are you extending yourself to help them get what they want? And that's a radical departure from I'm going to get what I want. And that was, you know, my generation went from in that world of the me generation of the 80s and 90s, like, forget about it. I'm just going to get what I want. And, you know, the Porsche, the house, the whole thing. And I'm going to exploit the system to my benefit. And that has never really stopped, you know, on one level. You know, we're not thinking of extending ourselves to somebody else. And that's basically, if we talk about karma, if you have the seeds, we call karma seeds in our time. And I love that word because it relates to growth or non-growth or something that sprouts and then gets eaten, something that sprouts and gets bugs and dies, or something that becomes, you know, a 78 kilo tree, you know, like. So here we are, you know, what's the relationship? Well, if you do something nice to someone else for the benefit of giving them your mind and heart, if they're having problems with their relationships, or what is it that we have to bear down to see what you really want? And if you don't know what you want, that's a beginning point, right? That I don't know what I want. Well, that's amazing. Write it down and look at it and put it on the fridge. Well, I'm at a place where I don't know what I want. I'm at a point in life where I have no idea what I want now. That's your starting point. And then you bring yourself to a place of finding somebody who's in the same position. And you don't have to look around too far to find people that they don't know what they want because they have everything. You know, they have a comfortable cave. My wife and I have a beautiful cave, you know, we live in. I have beautiful art. You know, I have an outside that works in a fountain that birds come. There's nothing. I'm happy with what I want. But something else is inside me that I don't know what I really want. There's something below that material surface that if we dive a little deeper, we can admit, I'm not sure what I want now. I'm in my late 30s. I'm financially maybe not sound. Maybe I need financial security. Okay, write it down. And then understand that you may not have the seeds, the karma, for that unless you take an action point to create the seeds for financial freedom. So what can we do? Well, we can't change this present moment. We can't. These are past seeds. Karma. If you believe in karma, and even on a level of like what goes around comes around, that's cool. That means there's a cyclical nature, that the universe works on a cyclical nature, that results come back to you from your actions of your mind, our thoughts, our speech, our body actions, and there is a correlation. And that correlation functions 100%. Not just sometimes or seldomly, it functions. And that's what we have to own. And that's difficult to own because we have justifications emotionally to blame others for our situations.
And also because of the time gap, because of the cyclical nature.
Oh, the time gap,
you know,
is
it's
right.
Unfortunately, because, you know, I cannot see the results immediately, but logically and sort of cause and effect wise, you know, it is 100% so, but we don't see it. So that's why we always
totally
do a four-step thing.
Wow.
Just try it out. And I think you've explained beautifully how relevant these ideas are, and you went really deep. I'm really happy you did that.
I think we can make things happen in our future that we don't think is possible.
Definitely.
That's my whole point. It's like the core message. You can make things in your future happen that you don't think is possible right now. And it's possible. And it's not that complex. But it's taking clarity in your actions and then pursuing a path that relates to creating a future you'd like to walk into. And
You will see it.
You may not remember planting the karma for it, or you may. And if you start to understand those correlations of where it comes from, then the magic happens in your life, that there isn't a glass ceiling anymore. And you design, and this is, I say this everywhere, Eva, you know, you're creating your reality every moment. You are creating your reality listening to this kind of conversation. That's good seeds. Maybe you're picking up some ideas that you want to go deeper. Or maybe you think I'm full of a crock of, you know, crap. You know, but this is exciting because if you understand that we can only create what we walk into, and that the result of experiencing your life right now is where you are. There's an old Zen, you know, cliche, you know, like where you are in your breath is where you are. Stay there and count your breath, 1 to 10 for an hour. You know, my first meditation teacher was like, shut up, get on the cushion and count your breath from 1 to 10, 1 to 10, 1 to 10. And then if you can watch clearly the stories that your mind is creating your delusional reality around, then you're on the path. And, you know, that's a starting point in the old days, but there's more exciting worlds of knowledge and wisdom that have been translated since the 80s and 70s. And we're in a renaissance of unpacking these amazing philosophical worldviews that have existed and still will be in our world coming forward, on how to change our mind and change our world and change the reality you want to see in 2026 and beyond.
Yeah, and the next, I hear, 150 years. That's at least the plans for ALR.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's a whole other story, right?
Yeah, pretty amazing. I think that's really cool. Thank you so much for your time. I think ideas to chew on, because that's what we want people to do, to chew on these ideas and to think them through for themselves and to do an experiment. And I can only advise, because it's donation week, you know, I personally think it's particularly good seeds to give money to ALL. I have people who give €5 because they don't have much at the moment, but they do want
to. Doesn't matter.
ALL. You know, you see. I have people who, I had a friend who gave $1,000 per month. Wow. So whatever you have, I think it if you're interested in these ideas, I think it's a very good investment in your future, to understand the limitless opportunities of these ideas, to support ALL. I'll do it anyway. It has helped me a lot. I'm very grateful
thank you,
for you being Indiana Jones. And I'll post all the information about how this can be donated in Germany, Austria.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Switzerland.
We really do good work, and you know, hundreds and hundreds of scholars rely on our product, and you know, we support 67 people around the world every month with a middle class life in India, Nepal, and Mongolia.
Yeah.
We take care of our people. They stay for years and do quality work. So.
Yeah,
both the humanitarian seed and the, you know, the data seed is alive and well right now.
Yeah, and also, you know, the appreciation of these thoughts. I think gratitude. I'm personally very grateful that I have these ideas in my life, and I don't have to rely on science. I can dig deeper because I'm a deeper kind of girl. So I'm interested in really knowing about the world. So I'm so grateful I had the seeds to understand this and to be able to share them. And I've been donating for ALL for, I don't know, 10 years at least.
A long time.
A long time. And, you know, yeah. It has helped me deepen my understanding because I'm so happy about it. And I think this gratitude is also something that keeps these ideas in your life. Because I
totally
don't want to wake up tomorrow
gratitude.
And then think, oh, I'd rather do Pilates. So I want to keep on doing this and understand more and more. And I've been doing this for 15 years. And I still got like, what was that all about? And how do I work this out? And it's a journey that never stops being totally exciting. So
you got to keep your seatbelt on when you open up, you know, this wisdom, Pandora's wisdom of karmic correlations, especially, and be aware of the fact that you're ripening and purifying. And I love the idea of gratitude, and it works. And it's rare that we feel good about feeling good about the good things we do. Weirdly, our minds don't want to feel good about the good things we do for others and ourselves. And we have to get over that. It's not pride. It's simply rejoicing. And we don't rejoice enough.
So when you donate, don't forget to rejoice. Okay. So I know you have a meeting soon.
We have to learn.
Yeah, we have to learn.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for your time.
It's good to be with you again.
Yeah.
I'll see you this year, right?
Yes,
soon.
Soon.
Good.
I'm happy to see you also. So thank you so much. And
thanks again.
If you have any questions, anyone, just let me know. I can answer questions about ALL as much as I can. And I hope you support the course. And thank you so much, John Brady, for your thoughts
you,
and your wisdom.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Take care now.
Take care, bye.
Bye.
Wenn dich die karmischen Prinzipien jetzt angesprochen haben, dann empfehle ich dir, ein 4-Schritte-Projekt zu machen, um sie zu überprüfen. Und dazu gibt es einen kostenlosen und frei verfügbaren Videokurs auf meiner Webseite. Du kannst aber auch sehr gerne in den Karma-Club kommen, auch wenn du nur erst ein paar Podcast-Folgen geschaut hast. Denn durch die wöchentlichen Treffs und die Gruppe bekommst du alle Hilfe, die du brauchst, um mit Karmic Management schnell Ergebnisse zu sehen. Ich freue mich auf dich.